Welcome back to Emerge. On this episode, I'm joined by John Michael Greer. John is a prolific author who I've known about for some years, but his recent article series on the CAC Wars is the focus of our conversation today. This is a remarkable series that I encourage you to take a look at, and it forms the basis of the conversation that you'll be hearing today. It's an account of how magic, esoteric magic, magic with a K, was used to influence the outcome of the 2016 election. It's a fascinating story, and it's an important lens through which to see our time. It helps make sense out of some of the forces that are at play in our cultural landscape, and in particular in the landscape of politics and in the fight for power and sociocultural transformation. I found this conversation to be very provocative. I don't necessarily agree with all of the political positions that John shares in this episode, but I love having conversations like this that help me kind of threaten or undermine the ways that I see the world. I think it leads to a level of humility and open-mindedness. And so I hope that you enjoy this conversation. I hope that it's provocative for you too. And if you'd like to support Emerge, you can do so by clicking on the link in the show notes or by going to anchor.fm/emerge and clicking on the button that seems like it's the one you click on if you want to support the show. Okay, enjoy the episode. Welcome back to another episode of Emerge. This time on the show, I'm welcoming for the first time John Michael Greer. John is a widely read author and blogger whose work focuses on the overlaps between ecology, spirituality, and the future of industrial society. And if you ever want to feel, very impressed with the body of work of somebody, I highly recommend you check out all of the various works that he's done. They run a very wide gamut of kind of orientations and explorations from spirituality to paranormal phenomenon to peak oil and everything that you might imagine existing between those various spaces. I first learned about John, your work from James Howard Kunstler, when I was kind of falling into a peak oil rabbit hole, which, I think is a rabbit hole worth falling into, but it's a kind of depressing place to spend all of your time. I explored your work a little bit from that perspective, but then more recently got back into your writing because of a recent series that you released called The CAC Wars, which is a four-part series that explores how, how the occult and magic influenced the outcome of the 2016 U.S. presidential election. And I and many of my friends who I shared this with found this series incredibly provocative and just kind of like a way into seeing some of the underlying patterns that were at play in this election that, for many people, depending on their kind of sense-making strategies of current events, just kind of knocked them over the head and made them feel like they didn't know which way was up. And so I was hoping that we could kind of explore how we might make sense of the 2016 election and all of this that was going on from a kind of magical perspective. And so thank you for coming on the show. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me on. Thank you also for your kind words about my writing and so on. I suppose it's that I get bored easily. And so I tend to say, okay, what do I want to look into next? I agree with you about the peak oil rabbit hole. It's an important thing to study, but at a certain point, everything that's been said about it has been said, and it's time to go on to other things. Thus, a lot of my recent political writings, and thus this whole exploration of the intersection between magic and popular spirituality on the one side, and bare knuckle politics on the other, that ended up with the Keck Wars and with a variety of other things. Let's see. To make sense of the 2016 presidential election, you have to start with an assumption, which is generally a useful one in America today, that both sides are lying through their teeth.
Yes.
Yeah. There are no good guys in this story. There's no glowing, shining vision of truth and justice and purity running for president. We had a run for president between, as usual, a contest between two profoundly corrupt parties, each of which is primarily interested in supporting its own, the power and wealth of its own constituencies, and both of which were, one of which was trying to do what presidential campaigns have been doing for a long time now. We'll take Barack Obama's successful campaign in 2008 as the great example. Hope. Change. Yes, we can. What the heck do these things mean? What do they amount to in terms of policies, in terms of what we can expect from a presidency? Nothing. Nada. Mm. They're noise. They're incantations. And Obama was extremely good. He was good at a certain kind of incantation. He was good at making a lot of people feel this warm, fuzzy glow that everything was going to be all right, and smiling Barack Obama was going to lead us to some glorious future not otherwise defined.
Right.
And he was really good at using these meaningless incantations to whip up that emotional state and get people and especially get people of certain classes to fall in line behind him, even though he wasn't actually offering them anything different.
Well, one of the things that you said, and I don't know that most of my audience will be too familiar with this kind of more, I guess we might say, like, kind of postmodern understanding of what magic is, you said it in the first article, that you're kind of playing with this definition of magic is the art and science of causing changes in consciousness in accordance with will. Which is kind of broad enough definition to include, clearly, campaigns, political campaigns, but also things like marketing and all of the different facets of how we try to persuade others to see the world the way we see. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, the thing to keep in mind is that although this definition fits a kind of postmodern sensibility very well, it actually was come up with back in the 1920s, Dion Fortune, who was one of the great 20th century occult teachers and practitioners, that was her working definition of magic. And so, the thing that it points out that's very useful is that magic is not Harry Potter. Okay, yeah. No magician ever picked up a wand, pointed it somewhere, said "Ungrammaticus Latinus" or something gibberish like that, and had a lightning bolt fly out of their wand. Okay, it does. Doesn't work that way. That's not magic. That's Hollywood. Okay. Mm-hmm. I always have to mention that to people because that's the context people've got.
Yeah.
But magic is about shaping consciousness. It's about shaping consciousness using a variety of means, some of which are currently accepted by modern science, some of which aren't. They all work. Scientists just have hang-ups about certain things, and that's fine. They'll get over it eventually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think what's important to notice in this kind of definition of magic is that you're already like performing within the domain of magic. It's almost an inevitable part of being human and interacting with other humans. But there is a difference then between doing things within the domain of magic as we understand it and being kind of meta-conscious of the fact that you are performing magic, which is more where we're going to be driving this conversation. But in any case, you're applying this frame of understanding presidential elections in general as kind of incantations and opportunities to perform magic on the public. But continue, please go on with that kind of analysis.
Okay. Well, the thing is they vary. Basically, it varies in the amount of incantation versus substance You have political campaigns that are about substance, where there's substantive issues being debated, there are actual policies in play, and the way of causing change in consciousness that plays the most importance are things like rhetoric and communicative skills and things like that. Then you have the kind of political magic you get when all of the sides are actually in favor of the same things, and it's just a personality contest. We saw this with Obama. There was this whole hopey changey business, and then he got into office and he copied all of the policies of George W. Bush. He just doubled down on everything the Democrats have been shrieking about for 8 years. Barack Obama started doing, the Democrats said, isn't it wonderful? You know, now it's a Democratic president who's blowing the crap out of wedding parties on the other side of the world or what have you. But the problem here was precisely that I'm going to introduce a concept here, the political class. Mm-hmm. Okay, the political class of a society are the people who are actively involved in politics, the people who have enough influence to make their voices heard. It's a very large sort of diffuse group of people. It's always a minority. That's true even in a relatively open democracy. There are a lot of people who simply they aren't interested, or they don't have time. They're spending too much time working. They've got other concerns. Most people are outside the political class. But within the political class, up until 2015, for quite a few decades, there had been total consensus on what political, economic, military policies the United States should follow. And it was purely a matter of prancing around and finding little point issues on which they could pretend to have arguments. Mm-hmm. And so that was what was going on. We had basically one political party divided into two halves that were constantly squabbling. And so you had the Democrats who would throw a few crumbs to the environmental movement, who would throw a few crumbs to ethnic minorities, who would throw a few crumbs to gay and lesbian people, and so on. And then you had the Republicans on the other side, who were now and again throwing a few crumbs to the evangelicals, throwing a few crumbs to gun owners and to their captive constituencies. And in that kind of context, when you're not actually interested in change, the gravy train is rolling and you just want to keep doing what you're doing in the political class, this kind of incantation-based campaign is very effective. And this is what Donald Trump, through a monkey wrench into when he started campaigning in 2015, because he was talking about policies, and he was talking about policies that were completely outside of the conventional wisdom of the accepted consensus of the political class. Now, okay, a little bit of socioeconomic material to go on here. That's actually crucial to this story, which is that during the 40 years or so that we've had neoliberal economics in place and the specific set of policies that we've been following for these last 40 years up until 2017, the American working class has been destroyed. Mm-hmm. Okay. When I was young, when I was a kid, okay, a family of four with one working class income could have a house, they could have a car, they could have three square meals a day, they could have all the ordinary things that we tend to think American families have. Up until 2016, because things have actually picked up sharply since then, a working class family of four with one working class income was typically living on the street.
Yep.
We watched the destruction of the single largest economic sector of the American people. And it was done by exactly those policies that everybody in the political class was very much in favor of. On the one hand, free trade policies that allowed employers to offshore all their production overseas, unlimited illegal immigration producing a huge underclass in the labor force that could be exploited with impunity to drive down wages and working conditions, and hyper-regulation of every economic activity, which the really big corporations can get out from under, but your small business can't, which was meant to centralize wealth in the hands of the big corporations. Those were the big three policies. Everybody agreed on them. Everybody, people would pick at little details, but that was the conventional wisdom. Trump shows up. Trump shows up and says, no, we're going to change all three of those things. We're going to actually deregulate, not go through the sort of Republican two-step where we repeal two regulations and pass five more. We're going to enforce our immigration laws. We're going to use tariffs to prevent people from offshoring jobs. And of course, the political class melted down. Mm-hmm. This is where the magic starts coming in, okay? Because you have this very explosive political situation. You have an outsider who's talking about some steps that could actually help a very large number of Americans who've been getting the short end of the stick for 40 years. You have the political class, by and large, uniting around a bunch of business as usual candidates, ultimately around Hillary Clinton. And you have a lot of people out there in the fringes, a lot of people out there who are not doing, who have not been doing too well, people who have been stigmatized as losers because they aren't among the small number of people who are winning in the current under the current scheme. And some of them practice magic. Mm. So that's kind of our setup. Right. That's the situation we've got as we move into the opening of the tech wars. Is there anything you want us to cover before we go on?
Well, just to name, like, you know, that we're kind of exploring the breakdown of this political and I would say kind of meaning-making consensus. The Jordan Greenhalgh, if you're familiar with his work, calls it the blue church, right? This kind of alliance between the media, academia, and, you know, the mm-hmm. Democratic Party and also the Republican Party. I think you're pointing to, you know, there's a kind mm-hmm. of naive political consensus, sense-making consensus. And, you know, I think it you make a very good case too, that perhaps this sort of breakdown in that ability to maintain that consensus, you know, the rupture, it's interesting, emerged out of the chans, which as an internet user for many, many years, you know, it makes sense to me that is where the rupture would mm-hmm. begin and the fracturing yeah. begin.
Yeah, it was gonna happen somewhere in outsider culture.
Yeah.
One of the things that you get in a society that's intellectually fossilized, that has the equivalent of the blue church, that's a good term. It's a very useful term, but that has one established way of looking at the world, which of course greatly benefits the people in power, people in the political class, and usually screws everyone else. You get outsider culture. You get the people who are stigmatized as losers, the people who either didn't compete or couldn't compete or got shoved off anyway. And they end up somewhere on the fringes. And you know, depending on what the technology of the time permits, In France before the French Revolution, coffee houses. Mm-hmm. You have these little coffee houses scattered all over Paris and every other significant city in France, where people would just get together and hang out. And you had the equivalent of the guys going to the chans who would sit around the coffee house and sip coffee and talk. And that's where the ideas that made the French Revolution happen were born. Mm-hmm. In Russia, before the Russian Revolution, it wasn't in Russia at all. What happened was young Russians who were interested in these things would leave the country. Typically, they'd arrange to go to Germany or someplace to go to university, and they just neglect to come home. Mm-hmm. And you had these communities of impoverished Russian students scattered all over Europe, and they'd sit around and talk. And that's where the Russian Revolution came from. Mm-hmm. This kind of thing happens all the time. It happened. The American Revolution was brewed up in a Boston pub, basically. That's the way these things happen. We've got the internet at this point, and so the chans, of course, which started out as originally they spun off of a place to talk about anime, and they turned into a place where people get together and talk, a place for outsider culture to blossom, for people to be able to critique the existing order of things and to think thoughts that were not permitted mm-hmm. inside the blue church. And so you get a lot of the things that were going on in the chans were garbage, frankly.
Right.
You have, you know,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you have the 19th century pseudoscience of race and that kind of stuff. You have all kinds of crud like that. But this is what happens in outsider culture. Whatever is rejected by the mainstream culture, the outsider culture jumps onto. Be careful what you reject.
Right. Right.
So,
and at the very least, there's this kind of like this kind of experimentation, this kind of ferment that's happening. That, you know, from my perspective as a Reddit user, you know, all the good memes, all the funny memes came from a chance because there was just so much activity there, so much turning over, so much experimentation. And so it's the Chans serve a really interesting kind of ecological niche, I think, in the wider internet culture. And just to make it clear for folks listening, 4chan is the most popular and well-known of the Chans, but there's actually, I know of at least like three, right? There's 4chan, 8chan. You mentioned another one in the article, but there's many of them, right, at this point?
There's a whole bunch of them. And there are a lot of forums that have spun off from the Chans, and you have to know someone. This is what I'm told. I am not a habitué of these circles, but I've had people coming onto my blog, and I've been in contact with people who were very deeply involved in some of these things. And yeah, there's a whole network of this stuff going on, and yeah, it does serve a classic ecological function. You know, these are the fringes where new ventures come. This is where the conventional wisdom no longer applies. Anything goes. There are no limits, no sense of propriety. It just cut loose. And so you produce an incredible amount of garbage, an incredible amount of just plain weirdness, and all the new ideas.
Yeah.
As you say, all the really funny. I mean, 4chan was where the lolcat was invented.
Yes, right. Yeah.
Exactly. You can't hardly find, anything on the internet. You go to the internet, you're gonna have a lolcat or some other meme like that. They're the ones who invented that. They did a lot of this stuff.
Totally. I think it's so important. So important to say, just sorry, really quick, you might really think you don't like the Chans because of, their involvement with Trump, or you think they're racist. But if you like memes and you like lolcats, then you have to also appreciate the good and the,
exactly.
At least the hilarious that they produce.
Yeah.
So, it's a more complex phenomenon than just being like the sewer of the internet.
Thank you.
How it often gets portrayed.
And here's the thing. One of the things one of the signs you want to look for if you're worried that your society is sinking into intellectual fossilization is this extreme moralizing, the idea that people are good, in which case they're all good and nothing they can do can possibly be criticized, or they're bad, and if they're bad, everything they've done is evilly evil with a double helping of evil sauce on the side.
Mm-hmm.
Extreme moral dualism shows you that you've got a society with its head stuck someplace biologically improbable. Okay, and of course we have an extreme case of that now in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You get the idea where if you can find something that an author or a personality, a media person, you can find something they did wrong, then everything they've ever done is evil and they should be cast out with wailing and gnashing of teeth and tarred and feathered and it becomes, it's very Puritan.
Right. And so this whole kind of, all these ingredients are present, right, at this moment that Trump comes on the scene. And at some point, I'm not sure if you know when it was, like, is there an account of when Trump kind of got into the Chans and he started being something that they were turning over and playing with?
I have not been able to trace the first Trump-related post on the Chans. That would take a lot of digging. Sure. But the thing is, Trump was a natural for the Chans because he a reality TV star running for president, right there, they're going to be all over that. The irony of that, the multiple nested ironies, and he is so outspoken and frankly such a blowhard.
Mm-hmm.
He himself violates half these sort of accepted rules, not only of politics but of ordinary discourse in the classes to which he is
yeah.
to which he more or less belongs. So they would have scooped him up right away. But the other factor is precisely that. On the one hand, that he was doing an in-your-face attack against the conventional wisdom. So of course the Chans were going, he's our boy. And then there was the fact that he was directing his much of his campaign against precisely those policies that ensured that so many of these guys were stuck living in mom's basement next to the washing machine because there were drastically insufficient jobs, and all of the the other things that have held the that have moved the American economy outside of the upper classes that has grounded down the American economy over the last 40 years. Right. And you know, the habitualists of the chance are not stupid. And since being outside of the political groupthink, they were able to look at these policies, connect the dots, and say, you know, that makes sense.
Mm.
And so, fairly early on, in 2015, when the campaign was just getting underway, first it was stuff on Trump being splashed around, isn't that funny? And then it was, did you hear what he said? Hmm. And before long, he was their fair-haired boy. And lots of people were getting very excited about Donald Trump's campaign, especially because of his opponents.
Hmm.
You know, some people are very lucky in who in opponents are. And Donald Trump was hugely lucky there because, on the one hand, the Republicans ran probably the most pathetic crew a potential presidential candidate. I mean, if they had gone looking, you know, I can imagine the GOP collectively going down to Hollywood Central Casting and say, we need a nerd. We need a loser. We need somebody who inspires, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, the charisma needs to be about -2. Find us some people. Well, we'd have gotten the Republican Party's anointed 2016 candidates with Jeb Bush and Jeb Bush leading the pack. Okay. And so, I mean, against that crew, Donald Trump couldn't help but stand out.
Right.
And then the Democratic Party did him and the Republicans probably the greatest favor they've ever received and cheated six ways from Sunday to get Hillary Clinton as their, as their candidate against him. Bernie Sanders would have cleaned Trump's clock.
Yeah.
If Bernie Sanders had, if the Democrats had run the election in the primary election in a fair manner, Bernie Sanders would be president right now, and probably both houses of Congress, you know, would have been Democratic on his coat, would have, you know, ended up with Democratic majorities just in his coattails. So they shot themselves through both cheeks, and I don't mean the ones in their face. they shot themselves through both cheeks, you know, forcing, you know, cheating every six ways from Sunday to keep Bernie Sanders from getting the nomination. And what they got was one of the least charismatic figures in American public life, a person with an immense amount of political baggage, a person with the absolute absence of new ideas, and somebody who had no idea how to campaign. Mm-hmm. So they really went out
perfect
their
storm.
Way.
Yeah.
A perfect storm. Just, you know, if they had wanted to hand the White House to Donald Trump on a platter, I don't know they could have done a better job. But so this was the situation going on. And there were some magical aspects to that also, but
yes.
Let's see. It was in mid 2015, as far as I've been able to find, that some people on one of the chans, I've heard stories as to exactly where this happened, started finding out about this system of practice called chaos magic, and That's kind of a zooming off to one side too. It's an avant-garde branch of magic. It tends to be very, very postmodern, very ironic. Uses a very simplified set of magical practices. It's nothing like as complex or as hard to learn as a lot of the more traditional systems of magic. And it can be fairly effective if you work hard at it, like any other magical thing. Magic is not, you wave your wand and stuff just happens. It is hard work. It's heavy lifting. Right. But you can make things happen that way. And there were a lot of people on the chans who were ready to do something, who knew their way around memes, who had a fair grasp of symbolism, who had increasingly a lot of passion directed at Donald Trump. They wanted to see him win. And somebody hands them the tools of chaos magic. And so they start doing working. They started, which is, you know, what operative magicians call, you know, when people who aren't magicians talk about spells, people who are magicians talk about workings. Okay. And so they start doing workings, and a lot of them start doing workings. I don't know that anyone, I don't have any numbers. I don't know that anyone's had numbers, but there seems to be, there was a lot of stuff going on there. And Donald Trump proceeded to rise steadily in the polls. And the further he went, the more excited the Chans got. And the more excited the Chans got, the further he went. And that's where things started getting weird.
Mm. Yeah, and just to say, like, I'm chaos magic is the form of magic that I'm most familiar with, and I think I'll link to a kind of like PDF I found on DeviantArt about chaos magic that's really well done.
That'd be great.
So if you aren't familiar and you want to learn more, you can do that. But when you're saying workings, that's things like kind of creating memes or sigils of various kinds and trying to kind of empower different symbols, right, on behalf of a certain objective.
Exactly. It's basically the way magic works is you create a symbolic representation of something you want to have happen. And symbolic representation, what does that mean? It can mean almost anything. It can be a chant, it can be a talisman, it can be a statue that you energize with power, it can be a meme, it can be a sigil, which is a kind of geometrical squiggle that you use to embody your intention. Anything. And there are known ways. There are ways that have been worked out down through thousands of years to create these things and then to direct energy into them. I say energy, it's a metaphor, okay? But There is something that corresponds to the concept of magical energy. We don't know what it is. We know that it works. And there are various ways you can direct that into the symbolic representation you make. And the more powerfully you do that, the more it starts to shape the way other people think.
Mm.
Because when you're causing change in consciousness in accordance with will, you're not just causing change in your own consciousness. It permeates. It spreads. And so you have all these people, again, doing chaos magic. Typically, they'll be making sigils. Okay, and some of those sigils may be coded into memes. Okay, they may assemble a picture that is actually a sigil, but it doesn't look like one. But anyway, they're doing these things and they're doing these workings to charge these things with psychological, emotional, magical energy so that they have an effect on other people's thinking. So here you have all these guys, most of the young men, okay? So you have all these young men piling force into that effort, driven by their own wretched economic status in the failing economy we've had, and their own sense of grievance and their own sense of being an outsider, being thrown aside with the garbage. And so they've got a lot of emotional energy to put into the work. And so the chants are pumping this stuff out right and left, and weird things start happening. Mm-hmm. And now, some of it was really simple. Every post on one of the Chan bulletin boards has a randomly assigned number, and they're sequential, okay? But there's so much stuff coming, you have no way of knowing what number you're going to get. And there was this little habit of looking for doubles, double numbers, tripled numbers, things like that, dubs, trips, and so on. There was a whole what started out as a joke and then turned into a kind of contest. Who was going to get what number? And people noticed that whenever somebody mentioned Donald Trump, their chances of getting a series of numbers went way up. And at levels way above statistical chance. And of course, the classic one was the one where somebody just in the middle of a random flurry of, people posting stuff, the guy who posted Trump will win. And again, the number was 7777777. That was the point where everyone went, whoa.
Mm-hmm.
But there was that. There was Pepe the Frog, who had basically become the Chan's mascot anyway. And the whole, all of the confusions around that and people suddenly realizing that, noticing that Kek, of course, the term for laughter, Kek, 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 was the name of an Egyptian frog god. And the appearance of the song Chatelet, the Europop song from the 80s that had a frog with a magic wand on the cover and things. And it was by a band named P.E.P.E. And all of these cascading coincidences.
Yeah, and I mean, this is so fascinating, right? And not just an Egyptian god, but like it's a frog god, right? Of chaos.
It's a frog god, yeah.
Of chaos.
Yeah, Keck. Right? Yeah. Well, it's specifically this is one of a particular set of deities in Egyptian mythology which have the job of taking chaos and making the world out of it.
Hmm.
Okay. And so there are some frog gods, and there's some there's Keck and there's Keket, who is his mate, his, I'll use a fancy word here, his syzygy, his female equivalent in energy, and he's a frog, she's a snake. Don't ask me how that works. The Egyptians had their own way of thinking about such things, but yeah, he's the one who brings the world out of chaos, and she's the one who finishes the process of establishing it. Mm. Got this, but this power of bringing something new into being out of chaos. So it's chaos, but it's chaos going someplace. And so, yeah, very well.
It's like really crazy, though. I mean, looking in from the outside, I mean, Pepe was the first kind of artifact that I encountered, because I'm not a user of the Chans, but you know, I'm at it, so I'm kind of close to it, closer than a lot of the mainstream. And like the whole, like I had heard from about Keck, right? And then it's like they were using this term Keck and using Pepe the Frog, and it, they didn't yet know that it was actually a part of this whole mythos that they then they found after the fact. Like this is a crazy synchronicity, right?
Exactly. The thing, and that's the right word, of course. Carl Jung and Wolfgang Pauli, who was a Nobel-winning physicist, wrote this book called Synchronicity, discussing the way that meaningful coincidences cluster around certain kinds of phenomena, certain kinds of psychological phenomena. Magic is full of synchronicity. In fact, one workable definition of magic is the production of synchronicities in accordance with will. Mm-hmm. If your magic is going well, strange coincidences follow you around like cats following someone with an open can of tuna. and that's what was happening. They were just getting one of these things after another. And of course, that was when they threw all of their energy into the goal of making Hillary Clinton collapse in public. Mm. Because there were all kinds of rumors, as you'll remember, flying around about her health. And then she did. And that same day was the day that she had talked about Pepe the Frog and Keck and so on in a speech. She actually gave them free publicity. And they were going, thank you, Keck. and then that same day, she's going from the 9/11 memorial and goes down like a sack of potatoes. And has to be carried onto her, into her SUV, and so they're just from what I've heard from the people who were there at the time, they were all just kind of looking at each other, going, "This is scary. Let's do more of it."
Right, right. Well, I guess I want to spend a little bit of time just exploring what you know about what it was like to participate in those communities at that time, because like my sense, having spent a little bit of time bumping around in the Chans, is like I can't imagine that they at least started being like believers of an ancient Egyptian god, or even the idea of doing the magic might have been done somewhat ironically, but that if these synchronicities pile up, that they might have been like, mm-hmm. okay, like I guess this works mm-hmm. now, and then maybe that changed the way they related to it. Or do you have a sense of that kind of ongoing relationship?
Let's see. I started dropping in and lurking on a couple of the Chans in the spring of 2016. Mm-hmm. January 2016, I predicted that Trump was going to win, and for a variety of reasons, and that brought a number of people onto my blog who were habitués of the Chans and who were going, whoa. This guy thinks Trump's going to win, and he has this whole argument as to why. Interesting. But they were, I mean, despite the stereotype, they were very polite. Mm-hmm. They were not annoying. I mean, the people I get who come crashing onto my blog to scream are almost all from the far left. Mm. I used to have some neo-Nazis who did it from time to time, but they've gone away. But you know, the alt-righters who came, they were curious, they were interested, they were well-spoken. And in the course of talking with them, I figured out something really interesting was going on the Chans, and so I did some snooping around and started lurking from time to time. And I just, you know, go there and read the last, few hours, which is as much as I had time to, because they're very busy. And you know, going to the politically incorrect forums on there. And yeah, it started out as, oh yeah, it's for the wolves. Let's do a sigil. That'll be fun. Mm-hmm. And then the gets were piling up and the synchronicity started. What's this about this Egyptian god? And he's a god of what? And and by the time things were moving fast, there were a lot of people who were still doing it ironically, but they were doing it. And there were a significant number of people who were on the chance who, as far as I can, I mean, to the extent that you can tell from reading something on an internet forum, they were into it. They were seriously into it. And then Trump won. And there was this shockwave. I mean, we all saw the shockwave across the country, but the next day, next morning, I went to the specific politically incorrect Chan forum that I was mostly frequenting at that time, and people were just going, you know, what have we done? And but yeah, the a lot of people in that went through that process and saw the completely unthinkable happen. The entire U.S. political class defeated by a complete outsider who actually spoke to the needs of you know, the majority of working class Americans, and a bunch of internet slackers and a cartoon frog. And so, in fact, one of the things that I've seen happen since then, both in by way of things that I have connected to and I've heard from other people in the magic scene, is a significant number of people who had been hanging out on the chans, and you know, whether or not they were into the politics or not, they were hanging out there, they saw what happened, and now they're showing up at the various places where you can get training in magic, going, I need to know what I'm doing. This is scary stuff. I want to know what I want to. So, so yeah, I think you're quite right that a lot of people who, you know, started out, it was just the lulls, and then it worked, and then it worked, and then it kept on working. And then Donald Trump was, you know, sitting up there giving his acceptance speech.
Right, right. And I think that, well, and again, it's this like image of a perfect storm that keeps coming to my head, because like, you know, you say in the article that magic is the politics of the excluded, which, you know, makes a lot of sense. You know, when you deprive people of, you know, traditional modes of discourse, they have to turn to some ulterior mode. And magic is a very like kind of, it's oddly accessible because you can't really, there's nothing you can do to prohibit somebody from playing with their own consciousness in a sense. And yet, you know, so if magic is the politics of the excluded, but this was the first time perhaps in history where there was a candidate who spoke to those that were excluded, and then the excluded had access to like this media machine, this sense making machine of 4chan, and then you know the internet itself, by which things like Pepe the Frog could spread all over the world in lightning speed. And so they kind of not only were they practicing the kind of art of magic, but they had this medium by which to propagate these empowered symbols and to augment people's consciousness together at the same time, which is just like, holy crap. And we didn't even see it. People didn't even see it happen.
Right? People did not see it coming. The thing is, the internet is a lot faster than previous modes of communication of this sort. But that's all it is. The American Revolution was generated the same way. It's just that the hot new technology in those days was the printing press. Okay? And pamphlets and broadsheets and flyers served the same function that websites and forums serve now. And that in fact, as printing presses became widely available outside of government control, which happened largely in Europe in the 18th century. Before then, it had been fairly strictly regulated. In the 18th century, the printing press goes feral, and revolution after revolution after revolution after revolution. Magic was fairly widely practiced in those days, too. So the thing that made the Keck Wars, I think, most fascinating, the two things. On the one hand was that it had that, you know, the internet, basically the printing press on roids, and you know, this incredibly fast, incredibly effective means of getting everything into circulation at once. So there was that. But the other thing, of course, is the internet has another feature, is which is that it tends to leave tracks. Where, when broadsheets that came out of Ben Franklin's press in colonial America, a few copies survive of this and that and the other, but they were being used to things like, for things like lining pie pans. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, it's hard to trace. Whereas in a situation like the Keck Wars, sitting here at my computer desk, I can go through the archives of the Chans, and I can go to archive.org and things like that, and I can literally track the whole thing. And so that's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's also the case that the internet has kind of relieved us of a lot of the gatekeepers. And so, you know, it might have been the case that Benjamin Franklin mm-hmm. could participate in that kind of memetic revolution, but there were many people who couldn't. And now, in this case, you know, if you want to, mm-hmm. you can go play in 4chan and be part of this kind of very confusing space, right? So there's a way in which the medium is the message, right? Like the in the American Revolution,
Marshall McLuhan,
in the American uh-huh. Revolution, like it was elites writing broadsides of like their ideas about what politics should be, but in this case it's the excluded people of the internet, kind of like, I don't know, there's less there's a lot more chaos in it, which is fascinating.
Yes. Now, the thing is, it wasn't just the elites in the American Revolution. You have to remember, a lot of the people who made the American Revolution work. It wasn't the poor, it wasn't the really excluded, but it was a fairly broad sector of society that had the basic education and access. I mean, because Ben Franklin didn't write all his own stuff for the printing press. He was a professional printer. He would print broadsides for anybody who was on roughly the same site he was.
Right.
And there were a lot of other guys who were doing exactly that same thing. And so, you know, that itself was revolutionary because, of course, you know, go back another couple of hundred years and it was just the elite. And so you have this mm-hmm. process of increasing access to the tools of the distribution of ideas. And an enormous amount of the history of the last 400, 500 years has been profoundly shaped by that gradual spread of those tools, whether we're talking basic literacy, whether we're talking access to information resources by way of original things like public libraries, whether we're talking about access to methods of reproduction, whether that's print, whether it's a printing press on the corner, whether that's a mimeograph. That was a huge thing when it hit, when people could actually do their own mimeograph, their own broadsheets, their own things, you know. And now we have the internet and computer printers and things like that, which have taken it to an extreme. So you have this, the internet is the culmination of a trajectory, basically.
Well, and it, there's no reason to suspect it's going to suddenly stop, right? Like, it's not like this is going to be like, this was kind of, I mean, was this kind of more the coming out party of this mode of producing mimetic and magical influence, or was it like a kind of weird coming together of events that allowed this to play a part in the 2016 election? Like, I imagine that in 2020, like, they're not just putting down their workings, right? They're going to do something else again. Or what's your sense of that?
What my sense is at this point, and this is based on what's actually happening right now, what we're seeing is all sides are picking up the same tools. Now, not all of them are doing it competently. I've been doing a series of essays actually critiquing a set of workings that are being done by the by a group of Democrats to try to oppose Trump. And it would be nice if they were doing a competent job of it, but they're not. And so I've been using that as a teaching moment to get across some ideas of basic magical theory. But, you know, I'm sure there are Democrats who are actually paying attention. Mm-hmm. And who aren't stuck in some of these self-defeating habits that are so common these days. But so what's happening is that everyone's making a rush for the same tools. And so to some extent, 2016 was a bit of an anomaly because there was magic of a sort going on all sides, but it was what the military theorists call asymmetric warfare. Because the Chans, the people on the alt-right, they were using one set of tools with very distinct, positive, very effective tools. And then there was the stuff that was being done by in the Clinton campaign, because Magic can be very effective, but it can also be very self-destructive. It becomes self-destructive if you use it to pretend that everything's okay. And a huge amount of elite culture in America today consists of ways to stop noticing how bad things have gotten. You have all these people doing, well, they call it mindfulness meditation. What happened was they took one particular kind of Buddhist meditation, took all the spiritual content out of it, and turned it into a non-chemical tranquilizer. Mm. And you have people doing this stuff by the hour. Corporations are teaching, having classes for their employees because it makes them, you know, more docile. it makes them calm. It makes them not, you know, notice that they're wasting their lives for the benefit of the corporate masters. Mm-hmm. And you have all this sort of yoga light being taught these days. Again, all the spiritual content is cut out. It makes you very, very mellow. It makes you calm. It screens out all of the flashing red lights and the sirens that are telling you things have gone really wrong. Things are falling apart in important ways. And that's the kind of magic people on the Clinton side of things were doing all the way up to the election. Mm-hmm. There's a great book by Barbara Ehrenreich called Bright Sighted, where she talks about the downside of the cult of positive thinking. And you can, if you take that book and apply it to the 2016 election, you will see another of the very important ways that the Democrats shot themselves through both cheeks. They basically spent all their time convincing themselves that they were going to win, and to the point that they forgot that they had to convince the voters. And the voters had their own ideas. And what we're seeing right now is a struggle among various factions in the Democratic Party between some of them who are just doubling down on that and saying everything is fine and Trump, the only thing that's wrong with America is Donald Trump.
Right.
And if we just go back to the same failed policies we've been pursuing for the last 40 years, everything will be fine again. And that's not going over very well. And then you have people, you know, you have the Bernie-crats and you have some of the rising young radical Democrats who are out there saying, no, this was a wake-up call. We actually have to stand up for our ideals. We have to stand up for the ordinary people, not just the interests of the managerial elite. And they're getting places, but that's still going to be fought out. My guess at this point, and of course, I don't know, but my guess at this point, given the way the Democratic Party is fluffing things, is that Donald Trump will win re-election in 2020. And when he does, that's when you're going to see a colossal nervous breakdown on the left. Mm-hmm. And out of that will come, I think, the moment where people will actually say, okay, we can't just keep on doing the same thing and expecting different results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's one thing that is striking me as you're speaking about this is like, you know, as we said before, there's a way in which these people who are participating in these campaigns are already practicing a form of magic. They're trying to influence people's consciousness.
I wonder
to what degree, because something we talk about in the show is like, you know, the kind of insufficiency of a materialist worldview with regards to certain, you know, aspects of experience, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, exploration. And it's like, will the political actors that are able to act in apt, like without needing to depend on a materialist worldview, have an advantage in the kind of mimetic magic warfare of the future kind of campaign politics now that the kind of central sense-making institutions are breaking down? Do you have any kind of thought on that?
Mm-hmm. Very much so. Yes, I think you're quite right. I think that those who can adjust to the fact that the materialist worldview it's not false, it's incomplete. They're just leaving out too much. It yeah. works within its own context. And people who grasp that, the most obvious advantage they have is that they can use techniques that the materialists can't. Because the materialist is going to say, oh, well, yeah, I can use this meme, but I have to rely on the ordinary methods of people perceiving it, getting it on the internet. The mage is going to say, this is a sigil. I can project energy into this and have it affect people's thinking, even if they've never seen it. Mm-hmm. And it works. That's the thing about magic. We have a little acronym among practicing mages these days. TSW, the polite form of that is this stuff works. And it mm-hmm. does. Okay. And so People who have a pragmatic non-materialist worldview, not people who have a dogmatic worldview, who are saying, like the ones who insist the material world is just an illusion and we have to, transcend that illusion. Well, that's fine. Go ahead and transcend the illusion. The rest of us are going to have a party. those who can combine effective material action and effective transmaterial action, those are going to be the ones who have the wider range of strategies, the more effective toolkits, the more powerful magical workings, and the greater rate of success. Mm-hmm. And there's one other thing that's crucial, and it refers back to something we talked about a little while ago, which was this sort of radical moral dualism. We are right and goodness and truth, and they are evil. Mm-hmm. Okay? If you convince yourself of that, and you convince yourself of the ruling mythology of our modern age, the myth of progress, the idea that whatever you like is inevitably going to win in the end, okay? You're doomed. Because, and specifically, you're going to run into the kind of thing that's causing so many shrieking meltdowns on the left these days when reality fails to do what you tell it to, okay? Yeah. The great advantage that the Chans, the alt-right had in this struggle is that the left cannot even think of the possibility they can lose. Mm. I mean, they can have setbacks, okay? It can take a long time for the struggle, but it is central to their worldview that they must win. And therefore, they assume the universe is going to cover for their mistakes. They assume that their good intentions will always work out because, you know, history, the arc of history bends in the direction of justice or whatever, you know, claptrap you want to use. The alt-right knows they can lose. They know they're in a fight. They know they have to take advantage of every opening that's available. They have to defend against everything. The left doesn't know that yet. And until the left grasps that they're in a fight they could lose comprehensively, permanently, they could have their butts kicked once and for all. Until they grasp that, they're going to be like any other overconfident competitor in a situation. They're going to get their butts kicked.
Yeah, I mean it's really well said, and I think that's part of the kind of explorations we've done on the show is that we're heading towards a kind of choice point. I think as far as are we, we're going to commit to a certain kind of future society, and they'll be very, very, very different, and it really matters much more than say like a presidential election in 1970s did in terms of like the outcome for the next however many generations of human experiment, or even that the human experiment might continue at all. And so I feel like the left just doesn't kind of get like what's actually on the table. And I'm curious if you see anybody on the left who does, or like, is this a really, again, another asymmetric kind of relationship?
I have encountered people on the left who get it. They are tearing their hair out in clumps because there are not many of them, and they constantly run into this assumption that, well, of course we're going to win. Well, you know, that and that not only is our cause going to win, but we personally are going to win. We personally are going to get all these benefits and all these perks and all, you know, nothing bad can ever actually happen to us. And the people on the left I know who are watching this and just going, you morons. And it's not sinking in. And it's understandable because we're dealing here with massive cognitive dissonance. Mm-hmm. And here again, I think it's the mythology of progress that's doing it. Too many people have bought too heavily into this notion that history is a one-way street toward whatever they like. And that progress is going to take care of it all. That, you know, progress is the modern pseudo-materialist version of God. And they worship progress on their knees.
Yes. Yeah. And there's also, I'm curious what you think about this whole, like, you know, there was this 2012 mythos around the consciousness culture. And there's still this kind of like sense of the evolution of consciousness is kind of taking us to this better future inevitably or something. How do you factor that into?
I would refer to that as stark staring crazy. Okay. First of all, evolution does not mean progress. Evolution does not mean things getting better. Evolution means adaptation to conditions, and that's all it means. Talk to any competent biologist. They're absolutely tearing their hair out about this thing too. Evolution is not progress. There is no reason to think that there's this permanent progress of consciousness. We haven't progressed in any sense that in terms of consciousness. Come on. Just as one example, compare the last round of presidential campaign debates to the Lincoln-Douglas debates from 1858. Okay, The Lincoln-Douglas debates were made to a bunch of working-class Chicago guys, voters, ordinary voters. And yet these were Abraham Lincoln and Stephen Douglas debating the issues of slavery. And they were intelligent, they were thoughtful, they were well-spoken. They took
3 hours long,
too. Strong position. Exactly. Yeah. And they're still worth reading today. You read them going, wow, that's good. And you think of the vacuous stuff that passes. We have not progressed in consciousness over that, 150 years now. We have degenerated.
Okay, I'm gonna push back a little bit just because I'm curious to see where this goes.
Please do.
I think people who have this perspective might say something like, "Yes, well, there's a kind of deterioration within those contexts where they're having the debates, but you know, over here in Burning Man, for instance, we're really pushing forward into new frontiers of human understanding and human consciousness, and all this kind of stuff."
At Burning Man. Come on. There's nothing that goes on at Burning Man that didn't go on a reasonably sized Roman orgy in the second century BC.
Different drugs. There's probably different drugs.
Different drugs. That's all. Yeah. I mean, come on. I remember when it was LSD. Oh man, I saw the universe open up and this incredible thing happened. And it's called a hallucination joke. You'll get a vitamin E. You'll get over it. You see, that's the thing. People get the myth of progress is self-reinforcing because people will look for anything that they can say, oh, you see, this shows that we're progressing, and ignore the 15 dozen other things that show that we're actually sliding down the slope. And so the thing is, if you look at the history of civilizations, and this is kind of a hobby horse of mine these days, precisely because there's all this drivel about, you know, the evolution of consciousness. What happens? Civilizations rise and they fall, and the psychology, the consciousness, the mentality of people in that civilization goes through predictable changes between the rise, the crest, the decline, and the fall. We're doing the same things in different ways. We've got different tools. We've got more toys. But we're actually going through a set of cultural, intellectual, emotional, psychological, consciousness-related changes that were already familiar in the time of the Babylonians. So does this, you know, so we need to get over this notion that we're smarter than everyone else because we happen to live later than they are.
Yes. And I would say that there is, like you said, with Obama, this kind of power of hope. There's a kind of incantation of progress that typically in recent history has not lined up with like a kind of political will to then actually make systemic changes that might benefit the whole instead of, you know, partial elites. And so, you know, I think we can grant that like this whole myth of progress is, you know, incomplete, but so is the myth perhaps of dissolution, right? Like they're all stories that we're trying to like apply to the world. And it's to the degree that we are kind of flexibly able to move between them and pragmatically deploy them that really makes the difference. And so I can imagine somebody, you know, with that perspective, deploying a kind of like half ironically a myth of progress as an incantation in order to create the context for real change. Uh-huh.
Yes, but the problem is that the myth of progress has been deployed for a couple of centuries now to block change.
Right.
The idea is we don't have to change. Progress will take care of it for us. You don't have to change anything you do. Just wait for progress to solve it. The Wobblies used to have that lovely song where the chorus rang, you'll get pie in the sky when you die. It's a lie. Okay. Nice. And it's the same thing. The sky we're talking about, of course, is outer space. Now, that's the particular place where we're supposed to get the pie. Cue Elon Musk for as long as he stays out of prison on fraud charges. But basically, It serves exactly the same function as the Christian mythology of the second coming. I mean, Jesus will come and fix everything. Therefore, you don't have to, and you aren't allowed to change anything now. Mm-hmm. And so in the same way, we have this daydream of the Star Trek future where consumer goodies come out of replicators and everyone gets to zoom across the planet and everyone's happy and everyone's wealthy. And all of that serves to distract attention from the realities of our time in which, of course, a lot of people are in really bad shape and things are getting noticeably worse. So you could use progress for that purpose, but it's a very, very, that would be difficult. It could be done, but heavy risk. The likelihood of it blowing up in your face and actually supporting the status quo is extremely high. This is precisely why a lot of what has been done very effectively, including by Donald Trump, is to do the opposite. Say, we've slid. Make America great again implies it's not great anymore. It implies that things have gotten bad, and that's why that was such an effective slogan, especially among those who knew that for them and for their families and communities it was true.
Yes.
So he went against, of course, he nodded to the myth of progress, saying, well, yeah, we can make it great again. We can return to the route of progress. Short term, he was admitting that progress wasn't happening. Mm-hmm. And that was explosive and extremely effective. And so I have found it very useful in storytelling to use other metaphors, to talk about cyclical history, to talk about decline, to talk about, and to get past the idea that decline means apocalypse.
What does it mean? What does it mean instead?
Decline means that simply things get worse. It doesn't mean they all blow up at once. It means that things get lost. Energy consumption, say, declines. We have fewer technological toys. Population declines. It means contraction. It means economic contraction. All of, it doesn't have to end in a sudden explosion. That's part of the same mythology, which is a mythology of don't look at the future. Don't think about the future. It's either going to be the glorious proletarian world of progress, or it's going to be we all die at once. Either way, don't think about the consequences of your actions. That's what the whole game is about. Because if people actually stop and look and say, hold it, what's going to happen if this keeps on going the same way for more than a few more years? They're going to demand change because it's very obvious that things are not going well and that they're getting worse, not better, and that specific people and specific classes are benefiting from the fact that things are getting worse and not better. This is why decline, to my mind, is one of those explosive ideas out there. Not apocalypse, not progress, decline, contraction. Things getting worse, not just for a while, but imagine them getting the worst for the rest of your life and the rest of your great-great-grandchildren's lives.
Yes, and worse particularly.
That's how civilizations go down.
Yeah, particularly as you say, though, in the kind of economic dimensions, it does strike me that like we're in a unique position given the technology and...
Exactly.
That whole aspect of what we've been playing with in recent history to kind of like navigate that quote-unquote decline in a way that might actually... allow for a quality of life and general well-being that wasn't possible even now for most people.
Exactly. And that preserves some of the best achievements of the last 300 years of industrialism. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. But to do that, you actually have to think about it. You have to admit that you can lose. And again, as we were talking, it's the thing that the political class cannot conceptualize. That's the reason why they're going so bonkers. Every time Trump scores a victory, and he's scored quite a few of them at this point, they dissolve into shrieking tantrums because the world isn't supposed to work that way. The world is supposed to give them everything that they want. Oh, well, the universe doesn't care. This is to borrow a major source of pop culture memes these days, it's H.P. Lovecraft's great literary thing. Indifferentism. The world doesn't care. When you look out at the stars, maybe the stars are looking back at you, but they're going, what is that little squeak thing down there? Oh, it's called the Earth, right? And that sense that you don't matter in the great scheme of things, that you are not the center of the universe, that the cosmos is not going to rescue you from the consequence of your own bad ideas, that's shattering, but it's also freedom.
It's a kind of freedom, particularly from the kind of straitjacket that most of our culture finds itself in. I would say again, though, it is also not in some fundamental way true. Like, you can take on this perspective of cosmic indifference, but you know, that's mm-hmm. that's another perspective. It's one that seems to be an interesting antidote to the blinders that some parts of our culture currently have on. But there is, I just keep wanting to push it further to another integration level or some kind of coming back, or I don't know.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But the thing is, very few people can hang out for long at that place where opposites are true.
Mm.
Okay. Very few people can stay there for a long time. It's a good place to go. It's a good place to go and to spend time there and to get used to the fact that all of our stories are just stories. All of our narratives are just patterns in which we try to fit the blooming, buzzing confusion of the world we experience. But maintaining that for any length of time is difficult. At a certain point, you know, especially if you have to roll up your sleeves and get to work, you need to choose a story. And knowing that it's not infinitely, not absolutely true, say, this one measures my experience close enough that I'm going to run with it for now. And so the ability to go back and forth and to change stories actually is a very important part of magic. And there's a sense in which magic is simply a way of storytelling. You tell a story and you make it so convincing that people believe it. And if you can tell a story that includes things that are part of their experience that every other story denies, then you've got a very powerful story. And you've got a story that a lot of people may find convincing. And again, that's something Donald Trump is actually fairly good at.
Right. And it's also why I think understanding, at least in theory, how magic works is so helpful for navigating the world today, because you're going to have such a competitive advantage if you can sort of leap between narratives and see the world in radically different ways, knowing that, you know, nobody has any kind of ownership over the truth, but that there's just kind of ways of seeing and stories that, you know, some are interesting, some work better than others. So.
Yeah. And the crucial thing is that some work better than others in particular situations. Okay. There was a run about 300 years there where the narrative of progress really worked extremely well. And we need to honor that. Mm. We seem to be in a time now that it's not working so well. It's had a good run. Other stories may be better suited to our needs right now because they may fit our experiences better. They may highlight things that we need to pay more attention to. And so, you know, all stories are stories, but not all stories are created equal. The Democrats are finding out right now that their story just doesn't work because it doesn't convince anybody, or it convinces them, but it doesn't convince the voters anymore.
Yeah.
And so that's the other side to the, well, it's all just stories. You know, some story at any given place or time, there are stories that fit better than others. There are stories that lead you to constructive results, to the results you want, let's say. And there are other stories that can lead you to some very bad places.
Well, so this is maybe an interesting place to kind of draw the conversation to an end, which is like, say that I'm somebody who genuinely, or at least chooses to act as if I'm concerned for the future of the planet. Like, I would prefer that there is a future in which more people have a higher quality of life, like across all classes, across all kind of identity groups, whatever. Like, what is the kind of story or relationship to the world in terms of narrative arc that you would imagine being pragmatically useful to adopt in order to help be a part of making that happen, if it's a possibility of happening?
Well, the first thing you need to do, I don't think there's a single story.
Yeah,
I don't think that it's not that one stands out, but there are a range of possible stories. And the first thing that I think they would have to include is the possibility that you could lose.
Mm.
And the second thing they'd have to include is the fact that things actually have gotten bad. There is no outside force pulling us toward this better future that you imagined. Nothing is going to save us. Nothing is going to do it for us. Stories that tell that, that say that, are stories that encourage people to sit down and do nothing. That's what they're there for. But so it would be a story of challenge. It would be very possibly a story like the kind of thing that Joseph Campbell used to write about, where you leave the place you are. And you go on, there's this long transformative journey. And when you come back, it's not the same place anymore. because you're not the same person. So I think possibly a story of quest and discovery, especially in a situation like this one where we don't know how to do it. We don't have we don't have a blueprint for the society you have in mind. Certainly not one that fits within the actual what seem to be the actual limits of the planetary ecology and our resource, our available resource base. So quest, search, loss and recovery. There's all kinds of stories that could be woven around that, but it's got to start with the necessity for change, and the necessity for letting go of some things, and being willing to accept loss and being willing to accept limitations in order to make something better for the future.
Thank you, John. This is a really engaging conversation. I feel very like lit up by the just the conversation and the ideas that you've shared. So thank you for coming on and talking.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I mean, I enjoy being on podcast, but I appreciate being on. We've had a good conversation.